I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. South Africa, in the white supremacy and apartheid days, owned the media to propagandize its policy of racial separateness. Yet, strangely, it left room somehow for a strong-minded white opposition, not only on the fringes of politics, but in British-minded papers like the late Rand Daily Mail. In 1958, as black opposition was just getting organized, the white editor of the Rand Daily Mail called apartheid a sham. He said it was unworkable because it is set to run counter to the massed forces of world opinion and the tides of contemporary human progress. It took more than 30 years and a lot of struggle to vindicate that vision, and by then the Daily Mail was out of business. Our guest, Ben Pogrund, covered the home news in South Africa from 1958 until his paper died in 1985. He's had one of the remarkable careers in journalism, writing the first draft of history against censorship and against his own government, often against the grain of his editors and his readers. Any reporter wonders how many of us could do that year after year. Connection listeners, what does it mean in ours or in any society to cover politics with a long view of underlying issues of justice? Who does it in our country? Who's doing it in South Africa today? South Africa has one-party black majority rule, and it has corporate newspaper ownership that is still strikingly white. Connection listeners, do you read Ben Pogrund's In Your Media, telling you straight the news that you're afraid of? Make the connection with Ben Pogrund and his memoir of a war of words at 1-800-423-8255. Connection phone is 1-800-423-TALK. Welcome, Ben Pogrund. It's never easy to tell people what they don't want to hear. You did it with your readers for a professional lifetime. How did you get away with it? And I don't mean just to flatter you. What made it possible?
Well, I didn't quite get away with it. I was prosecuted a number of times. I went to jail first just for a few days for refusing to reveal the identity of an informant. But then I wrote a series of very big reports about prison conditions, horrific prison conditions involving blacks and white political prisoners. And the next 4 years of my life went into a never-ending series of trials. And it ended with I was found guilty of publishing false information about prisons according to the charge sheet, although everyone knew this stuff was true. But that went 4 years. And then once they get into you, there's no end. They seized my passport. I wasn't allowed to leave the country for the next 5.5 years or so. And then they went for me again. I was working on a PhD about African nationalism. I got raided. And as a result of that raid, I was involved in another long trial, possessing banned newspapers. Mm-hmm. They found me with three copies of a newspaper which had been banned 25 years before. So I went through that lot. So it never ended, you know. Once they got onto you, it just went on and on and on. So there was a price to pay. And finally, of course, the paper was closed down. And I left the country at that point, and I've kept very closely in touch since, but that was my life.
You were the sort of hard-pressed, isolated, discredited voice of what, as you say, everybody knew fundamentally was the truth. What difference did it make, do you suppose, that there was that little throbbing light in the darkness that said, don't believe it?
Well, I was only able to do what I did because of editors. When I joined journalism, the Rand Daily Mail, I came from university with several degrees in 1958, and a new editor had recently taken over by the name of Lawrence Gander, and no one really expected much from him. He came from a very conservative part of the country. He was English-speaking, he was very mild, quiet-spoken, and yet there was a steely determination in him to produce a better newspaper. And he happened to agree with what I wanted to do, because my main criticism of the mainstream press at the time was it reported only on white South Africans, on the minority. And to me, journalism meant reporting on the totality of South Africa. That was my very simple belief. And Laurie Gander accepted this and allowed me room in which to report. I was up against the whole establishment on the newspaper. And these are all whites, schooled in white thinking, white prejudices, and they simply hated this torrent of stories about black people. black politics, black living conditions, all of it which no mainstream paper had done before.
But what made your position possible, it sounds as if, was that you had this English-speaking, English-loyal, white minority of a minority, which loved sort of challenging the worldview of the Afrikaner white folk.
Well, I wouldn't put it quite as strongly as that. It was a very curious set of contradictions, because the ownership of the paper were white conservative businessmen, and they hated what the paper was doing. And after a short while, they were trying to get rid of Laurie Gander. But also on the board of directors were people who believed in what Gander was doing and what the paper was doing, and they were very loyal. There were some marvelous examples for years of total press freedom. For example, when I wrote and Laurie Gander published this series of reports on prisons and all hell broke loose, the government just went for us. There was never the slightest attempt to pressurize either me or Laurie Gander. Never, ever tried to get us to recant. The board stood by us solidly. They didn't like it, didn't like the publicity. It took up nearly a year's profits for the company. But no one ever said, back off. Later on it changed. Later on, management changed and became as hostile towards us as the government. And that's why the paper was finally killed off. The managers changed, the owners changed, and they simply ended the paper.
The roots of a kind of defiant free press go way back in American history, obviously. What were the roots of that kind of fight the power, we're independent, we're just here to tell the truth, print the news and be damned kind of thing? What was the basis in law and culture for that kind of thinking in South Africa? I'm particularly interested to know how it applies today in South Africa. Are there Ben Pogan needles and thorns in the side of the black majority government today? Must there be?
Well, take your first point. It goes right back to the 1820s when the first newspaper started under British colonial rule, and there was an attempt by the British governor to suppress the newspaper, and that battle was won. But for the next 130 years, the press had virtually total freedom, but never used it. It was a press devoted only to white interests. Blacks didn't exist except as when there were riots involving blacks or as criminals and so on. Then when things changed, it was basically Lawrence Gander who led the way on this, and he collected around him a group of journalists. I was only one of them, all of whom shared his ideals, and he allowed us scope to develop the paper. Today it's a very different situation. This is a society in transition. It's come through several hundred years of white rule, the last four decades of Afrikaner nationalist apartheid, with some really terrible things happening. And it's a difficult task now to run a newspaper. It's a different order of things. Previously, you had to stand up to authority, to the tightening noose around the throat as we were being strangled into silence. Today, you've got to show much more subtlety. You've got to walk a fine line between being adversarial and at the same time trying to help government through these very difficult times.
That's a tricky path. John Madison is on the line from South Africa, radio reporter and writer, sometimes with NPR, an important man in that country in as much as he was part of the commission that redistributed broadcast licenses when the African National Congress took over the government. John Madison, how does one thread the path between a simply adversarial free press and a press that's building a new world?
Well, I think the real protection, Chris, if one takes a step back, the real protection for the society is to have real competition and diversity in the media. And we've done that a lot with ownership. Just to go back to something you said a little earlier, I think you said that, if I understood correctly, that the ownership is still substantially in the hands of the big white companies that it used to be. And that's not entirely...
Not the same companies, John. I was thinking specifically of newspapers, not broadcasting.
No, but even with newspapers, there is a fair amount of black ownership of the newspapers and diversity. That's not true in the smaller towns at the coast, but in Johannesburg, you have quite a number of different black media companies that control substantial newspapers. The highest circulation paper in the country is the Sowetan, and that's black-owned and run. And there are some others, and then there are various combinations. But the thing is, of course, that that doesn't change things as much as people expected. The new owners come in and face commercial exigencies. And so in many cases, they haven't changed all that much in the newspapers that they now control. But I do think that the long-term key is to keep diversity of ownership. Because to get back to the beginning of your question, what people write and so on is constrained, as Benji Pogan, the government is impatient with criticism. It's increasingly impatient. In 1994, just after the election, in the sort of Prague spring we had, everybody was open to the free speech ideas that that one would like to see supported. But now, when things go wrong, the government gets tetchy, and I think it's also true that sometimes the newspapers are a bit thoughtless. They criticize the government for things over which the government really doesn't have control. So it is a difficult line to walk.
It's a difficult line, John, in many respects. You're talking about the government getting super sensitive to press criticism. At the same time, on my couple of visits to South Africa, the most conspicuous newspapers that a tourist sees are owned by Tony O'Reilly, an Irish citizen, head of the Heinz pickle fortune. And in his papers, you would think that white rugby games were the main activity in all of South Africa.
Well, that's true. Tony O'Reilly knows Nelson Mandela and was in constant contact with him at the time he wanted to buy the papers in 1993. And he bought control of the biggest newspaper group in the country. And that gives him a monopoly in several towns. And I just don't think that's very healthy. It doesn't.
What is the arrangement with Nelson Mandela and the ANC? I mean, is he the press lord for the black establishment? I mean, it's an interesting combination.
No, I don't think it's quite as simple as that. In fact, I think one would probably have to say he got control at a very low price, both in commercial terms and also in political terms. I think he was expected to bring in more black editors and things like that, and he's done that to some extent. And beyond that, he really wasn't asked to do very much. Now, there is some frustration in the ANC that his papers don't do more for them, but he's not really expected to do very much except that he has business interests here, and he seems to have decided of his own volition that he doesn't want a real feisty challenge to the government.
What kind of agenda do those papers set for their readers and the country every day, would you say?
Well, it varies. I would say that they have bought into the government policy of what they call transformation. And transformation means different things to different people and is used in different ways. Transformation is supposed to mean changing the society and shifting it from serving only the white interests, as it did in the past, to serving the deprived black population that has been unserved all these years. Now, that, of course, is commendable, and I don't think anyone would disagree with it. But the question then is, what does it mean in practice? And sometimes you get the feeling that transformation is then used by either the owners or the editors of papers to say transformation means we should get the top jobs, and some of the white editors who or even black editors who've taken a more independent political line feel some pressure, and it comes now also from some of the journalists.
John Madison, I don't want simply to flatter Ben Pogan, but the truth is simply that the reporters we remember are always the Ben Pogans of the world, who told us, who were these rather difficult characters who kept insisting on telling us things we weren't ready to hear, not necessarily about South Africa, not necessarily on racial lines. Question is, and it applies to us too, but in South Africa today, is there room for a black or a white or anybody, Ben Pogrand, to look at the world and reset the agenda through one man's conscience?
I think there very much is room, and to some extent there are some writers doing it. But I suppose we now have a kind of cacophony of a lot of different views, and a time where the whole society is in the middle of change, and so anything that it's not nearly as clear, you know. Of course, it's trite, but it's true that then you had a clear moral issue. You were on the good side or the bad side. Now you may come out. If a writer writes something that he believes is or she believes is utterly in the interests of a moral perspective, you can be absolutely sure that some other writer will knock him down the next day and say, that's a purely self-interested view. So even if you do get that kind of writer now, I think it's not necessarily going to be universally recognized.
Ben Pogren, who's your successor? Who would you like to see take up this story?
Well, I think the Mail and Guardian, which was the paper which, when the Rand Daily Mail was killed off, a number of our younger journalists went off and started this alternative paper on a shoestring called the Weekly Mail. And that, together with another newspaper, an Afrikaans paper, Freya Weekblad, were the two leading exponents of pushing for exposing the terrible things happening in apartheid in the last few years. And the Mail and Guardian is still doing that. And it's having a lot of problems because of that. It is a pretty clear voice. It's got problems. It's got problems of quality. That in itself is a huge difficulty in South Africa. If you want to have very good, courageous journalism, you've got to know what you're doing. You've got to be able to take on authority. You've got to know how to work your way around the laws and all that sort of thing. And as John was saying, as I was saying earlier, this is it's a very difficult transition situation at this moment. The Mail and Guardian does it. You run into the problem, there's corruption. The new group of blacks, there's quite a lot of corruption there. And whites tend to point the finger and say, you see, when you have black majority rule, this is what happens. They ignore the fact that under the Afrikaners, the corruption was immense. It was hidden. Now there's transparency, so you can report on the thing. The Mail and Guardian reports on it, and it starts running into difficulties because some black people say they are focusing on blacks, whereas I think they're simply doing their job of reporting on society. They are having difficulties there because of it, but they
do they face censorship and official secrets acts and this kind of harassment?
No, not at all.
No, I don't think there's anything like that. You know, we really are, in many respects, one of the freest countries in the world in terms of our constitution and the laws. But as Benji says, the practice is tough because you do a story which you believe is motivated by pure altruism and the best traditions of independent journalism, and someone in a high level in government then says, but you're just doing it because the person is black. And, of course, that's an unpleasant accusation to face.
We're talking about Ben Pogren's memoir of 30-some years of reporting in dissent for a brave white newspaper, the Rand Daily Mail, 1-800-423-8255. But the matter of dissent in newspaper voices is a universal necessity, too. 1-800-423-TALK. John Madison joins us by phone from South Africa. Peter is calling from his car.
Yes, good morning.
Hello, Peter.
I'm actually a Cambridge resident, but I'm on my way back from a night on Block Island, and it was nice to hear this. I lived in Zimbabwe years ago in 1985, and I used the Rand Daily Mail, the old copies that I would get through the library to teach my students a great deal of not only South African history, but the whole region and its neighbor, northern and southern Rhodesia. My question is, and it was a terrific paper to read and use as a tool. My question is, given you mentioned corruption a moment ago, current state of Africa and its neighbor, Zimbabwe, the outlook looks more gray than it was when I was there 12 years ago when change was starting to really look for the better. What is your honest outlook? Are you sanguine? Are you optimistic? Or are you do you think that there's worse times ahead before things get better?
And what's the definition of victory, Peter?
My definition of victory, freedom.
Ben Pogren.
Well, I don't think you can just talk about Africa. It's a huge place. There have been a lot of bad things, and they're still bad things. Zimbabwe is a very sad scenario. When Robert Mugabe came to power after the defeating white rule, he came out of prison. He was an aesthetic. He'd been very well educated in his years in jail, and things looked pretty good. But something very strange has happened to this man, and I think he's gone in a very different way. And the country is a mess, there's no doubt about it. And the coming elections, one hopes, will bring it back to sanity. I mean, the way he's talking now, his argument with Britain, is, you know, borders on craziness, quite frankly. There's no other word to describe it. And it is sad. I don't think South Africa approximates that in any way. South Africa has got a heavy heritage from the past. You name it, it's got problems. You can't simply press a button and everything comes right. For the last few years when I was on the Mail, I was the chief editorial writer, and the message we kept propounding day after day was the longer change is delayed in South Africa, the more difficult the transition will eventually be. And of course, that is exactly what has happened. Had whites settled much earlier and done a deal with the black majority, it could have been a much easier changeover. There are difficulties. It's going to take a long time to sort them out, whether it's education, health, crime, the police, you name it, it's there. But I think the country's moving towards it, and I'm very optimistic about South Africa.
Peter defined a victory as freedom. What about something like or firm steps in the direction of economic equality?
In South Africa?
Yeah.
Well, again, you can't press buttons, and there are problems at every level. People who were denied education deliberately under apartheid, you've got to train them. They've got to be educated to take over. You can't produce a newspaper editor overnight. You can't produce a judge overnight. You can't produce a highly trained doctor overnight.
Ben Pogrund, our guest, has been a journalist in South Africa. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 or 1-800-423-TALK makes the connection with Ben Pogrund's memoir of dissenting journalism on the Rand Daily Mail in South Africa through the apartheid years. You can't press buttons, indeed, Ben Pogrund, but you can set timetables and targets. What are yours for South Africa?
Well, I don't think I can't set a timetable. I just think it's from day to day. I think it requires a lot of good sense. Nelson Mandela gave the country a golden, magical first 5 years of reconciliation. It was amazing that there was not more bloodshed than actually did happen. It's literally one of the miracles of our age. Now there's much harder work having to go in. The reconciliation wasn't total. There's still a lot of white arrogance, a lot of white distancing from black aspirations. There's a lot of resentment on the part of blacks, a lot of desire, as John Matteson was saying, to move on, and it simply can't happen immediately. Now you've got to get to grips, and Thabo Mbeki, the president who took over last year, is applying himself to that, and it's a long, hard haul. I don't think you can set a timetable and say that there's going to be a five-year program. There are things that are being done. Houses are being built. Hundreds of thousands of houses are being built. Water is being provided to people who never had water. Schooling on a proper basis is being provided. Health is being extended to the whole population and not mainly for the minority whites. And it's a very messy, problematic process. And health, in fact, at the moment is in a considerable mess because the idea is to put people in touch with clinics in rural areas, but they're short of facilities. And meanwhile, the money for that has been taken from the central hospitals in the towns. But people are still coming to the towns for the hospitals, which are now underfunded, under-resourced, so there's just a total big, you know, logjam in the hospitals. It'll be sorted out eventually, but it won't, you know, whether you can say 1 year, 5 years, 10 years, it's going to happen, but I don't think you can simply say, give it an exact timetable.
Nelson Mandela, in the 60s, when you first knew him, was sometimes in hiding, and then long time in prison. He was codenamed the Black Pimpernel in your correspondence with him. How well did you get to know him? And then I'd love to also to share your personal experience of Thabo Mbeki.
To take the second first, Thabo I don't know all that well. I've known him to some extent over the years when he was in exile. His father I knew rather better. His father spent most of his life in prison with Mandela. And I was in touch with him while he was in prison, and I saw him a number of times when he came out. Mandela goes back a long way. When I was a very young reporter and he was a leader in the African National Congress, I was getting to know him. And when he went underground, I was one, I think, as far as I know, only one other reporter was in touch with him. And we had a system of him dropping messages for me, or else I would drop a message for him. And I would meet him on a street corner in Johannesburg at night in one of the suburbs. And this tall, imposing man with this great authority was wearing a worker's boiler suit. That was his disguise. In later years, I don't know if I would have met him in those circumstances, because had I been caught with him, I would have probably spent the rest of my life in jail, and his followers would probably try to kill me. They probably thought I'd set him up, because that was the paranoia at the time. But being young and naive, and I liked Nelson and I respected him, we simply met. And I was eventually able to see him in prison. I was the first non-family person to be allowed to see him. I think they let me in as a guinea pig. Not as a journalist, I had to give an undertaking not to write anything, but I saw him in prison, and I saw him again last July in South Africa.
Ben Pogrand covered Africa, the Black Revolution, for the Rand Daily Mail. His book about it is called War of Words. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston and PRI Public Radio International. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation, empowering people with innovative internet technology and offering dynamic career opportunities at allaire.com. From Boston University, this is I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection. Benjamin Pogrand, our guest, has written a memoir of a career in South African journalism. He was a white reporter for a white newspaper covering, as best he could, a black revolution from 1958 until the Rand Daily Mail died in 1985. 1-800-423-8255. We're talking about dissenting journalism in general in our world and in South Africa today. Mithatha Seydu joins us by phone from South Africa. He's the deputy editor of Johannesburg's largest newspaper, The Star. Mr. Seydu, thanks for joining us. I'd love you just to characterize generally, what's the agenda coming to its readers out of Johannesburg's biggest paper today and every day now?
Well, I wish The Star was the biggest paper. The biggest paper is the Sowetan. We're the second biggest paper.
Sorry.
And I think I sit here. I was appointed deputy editor of The Star in July last year, and we produce a newspaper that tries to reflect the new society. The Star was, during the time when Benji was still here and working for the Rand Daily Mail, a paper that reflected white society, and black people would only feature in the news pages of The Star as and when their misdemeanors impacted on white life. That is no longer The Star that we produce today. This is a paper that looks at the interests of society in general, and there's a lot of black people and their issues, and not just the crime level, but their own hopes and aspirations and their triumphs and tribulations that you find in The Star today.
Do you feel impelled, as Ben did in his career, to sort of talk back to your society too?
Yeah, I do that every week. I write a column called Black Eye, in which I write anything that I want to write about. I take Thabo Mbeki to task over things. I take Mandela to task over things. I praise them when they do good things, you know. And that there are sometimes reactions from those people who are in power. Mandela will sometimes call you into his house and talk to you. Mbeki will somehow find ways in which he'll make you know that he didn't like this and that. But for me, that is basically the same thing as the Washington Post publishing a story about Clinton and whatever shenanigans involving cigars, which Clinton would not like, and that is par for the course.
Hello, I'm just breaking in there. Can I ask,
Ben Pogrand,
ask about the how you feel about the quality of the journalism that goes into the Star and the other papers? You know, when I come to South Africa, I look at the papers and frankly my heart sinks, apart from some good columns. I know your column and it's a very good one, and there's some other good guys like Justice and Flala and people like that. But otherwise, when I come there and I look at the papers and I say I get very upset because there's clearly a shortage of good journalists of whatever colour, and I worry that the O'Reilly Group in particular isn't doing enough. In fact, they've dropped the training scheme to try and promote good journalism in South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, the standard of journalism, it's low in the country, not just at papers owned by O'Reilly. Maybe it's worse there, but it's generally low. And there are a number of factors, Benji, about this. One of them is the exodus of skills from the industry into either government communication services or into other areas of corporate life where companies that were looking for, especially good black names that were well known in journalism have plugged those people out of journalism and made them either directors of communications or corporate affairs or those kinds of things, which have eroded the level of skills within newsrooms. Mm. 10 years ago, if you looked around your newsroom, you would have an average experience of at least 10 years. Right now, as I speak to you, I look around, and the average experience in the newsroom of the Star is less than 5 years, and that must impact on the product that you eventually produce.
Mithatha Seydou, I want to ask you and John Madison about the hearings this spring on racism in South African journalism. What's this all about?
Okay, I'll go first.
Please.
The hearings were a result of a complaint by two organizations that felt that two newspapers were targeting black people and stereotyping them as either corrupt or bad people and stuff like that. One of those papers is the one that Benji was singing praises about, the Mail and Guardian. The Human Rights Commission then decided that it was not going to do a hearing into those two newspapers. It will do a hearing on racism in the media generally. And so what we've been going through is a process in which people in the media and other people in society generally have been asked to come and talk about their own experiences about either working in the media or how media impacts on them. And it's been a very interesting exercise.
John Madison, have you been following it? Have you been involved?
No, I haven't been involved. I'm a thousand miles away, but obviously I've been following it to some extent. It certainly had a huge impact in the society and in the newspapers. I think it's really had a kind of an effect of people taking sides in a fairly extreme way on one side or the other. It has focused attention on the fact that there is racism in the media. I think the jury's still out on whether it really produces a more sensitive, race-free environment in the newspapers.
I think there's certainly some...
I don't think, if I could just come in here, I don't think that the brief for the Human Rights Commission is really to create that that situation of a more race sensitive. I think the brief on the HRC is to be an avenue for debate, and they've been able to do that. The challenge is really on media groups to look at themselves and see whether the stereotypes around the coverage of AIDS, for example, where all kinds of people who are living with AIDS will be caricatured to be African people, and the experts who are trying to help deal with the AIDS, the scourge of AIDS, will be white people. Those are the kinds of things that challenge today's journalism and the stereotypes that the HRC is trying to deal with. And the challenge is not on them, it's on us as people who are in the media, to see whether we are able to deal with that challenge.
I think it would be astonishing if only 6 years after freedom, if there wasn't racism in the media, as there is racism in every aspect of society. And, you know, when you look at journalism in South Africa, a lot of the people are a carryover from the past, the journalists, and they've changed to some extent, but a lot of them, I think, are simply carry the same baggage as before, the baggage of prejudice. And that's going to take time to work itself out. I must say, the Human Rights Commission has done, obviously, some very alarming things. The way it sent out subpoenas to more than 30 editors to try and compel them to come is a throwback to what the nationalists, the Afrikaner nationalists, were doing way back in the 1950s and the 1960s when they ran press commissions. But I agree otherwise with what both of you have been saying. That
could I ask... Mithatha Seydoux, to be more particular on the matter of the AIDS numbers. For example, I mean, we all know that there's a deep human impulse not to face the horrible truth of that scene in general, in every society, and in individual cases. How do you pursue it when you know that the numbers may be just appalling in themselves, and they may be very, very imbalanced racially?
No, I don't think the idea is that African people who suffer from or who are living with AIDS should not be shown. It is the argument is really that there are white people who have even come forward. A judge in one of the highest courts of this country is a white judge who is gay, has come forward and said he's living with AIDS, but nowhere will you find his picture being used to illustrate a story around AIDS. People always go out to Baragwanath Hospital, which is a black hospital, to find little babies there and show them. If they want a story, they are writing a story that deals with women who are pregnant mothers or some such story. They'll go out to Baragwanath again and just even find people sitting in a queue of antenatal clinic and use that picture without even bothering to see whether those people actually are living with AIDS or not. But because they're black, you can get away with it. This is the thing.
I see. John Madison, I know we have to let you go. Do you want a last word?
Well, actually, if I want to take you backwards and forwards very quickly. To take you backwards, I think the value of what Ben Pogrin has been talking to you about and of the Rand Daily Mail during that period was that it was unpopular. As Ben says, it was he had support of his editors and great unpopularity with the white reading public. But what it did do was provide a kind of bedrock of ideas of how a constitutional state could run. And I think it was extremely important when the time came for negotiation and a democratic constitution. The Mail did. Provide people who'd been reading the paper all those years had very firm ideas of how to do it. That's the step back. The step forward, just relating to the discussion about Zimbabwe, because, of course, publication isn't just print these days. Zimbabwe is embarked on this thing now where they're trying very hard to stop news coming in on the internet and so on, and there are even threats of blacking out internet sites and stopping emails that might be critical of the government. And that's the kind of very current challenge we have there. And that's, of course, harder to do these days. So that's, I suppose, one of the good things about the new economy.
John Madison in South Africa. Thank you enormously again, John, for joining us on The Connection. We're talking about opposition journalism in South Africa under apartheid, in South Africa today, in every society. 1-800-423-8255. Ben Pogrin's memoir of his own life as a South African journalist is called War of Words. 1-800-423-TALK is our phone. Vanilla is on the line.
Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Vanilla.
I was a visiting lecturer at the University of Witwatersrand for a year, a couple of years ago. And from that experience, I lived in Johannesburg. I came back with a helpless feeling that people in South Africa, both blacks and whites, were impatient with the government and change. It takes much longer than 6 years to reverse and overcome 30 years of economic isolation and many more so years of the oppression of the soul that was happening in South Africa. And I think the press, just like the rest of the people there, is being impatient with the change, with the rate of change. And I think I don't know if it is within the realm, the bounds of journalism, to be patient with the growing small sapling of a country. And I think that maybe that's what is needed.
But I think it's not so much the press which has to be patient, but it's the pressures on the people in the press. The press is reflecting what it's getting from society. And after all that black people have suffered for so long, people want to get a move on and have a better life. You have a situation, for example, with literally quite a few million people who have become squatters around the big cities. Around Durban, there are perhaps 1.5 million. Around Cape Town, 1 to 2 million. A couple of million around Johannesburg. So you provide someone, say, with electricity and a telephone, but he's still living in a shack made out of corrugated iron and cardboard. And comes the end of the month, he's got to pay for the telephone and electricity, and he hasn't got a job. So that's why you have impatience. Mandela was able to get people to hold on, to curb their natural desire for swift change, for the realization of their dreams. But it's getting tougher all the time to keep saying to people, hold on, hold on, it takes us time to do all these things. And this could lead to a lot of problems in the short term and in the medium term in South Africa. That is a great danger. So government has to produce as much as possible, as quickly as possible, and hold things in check.
Mthathu Sethu, do you feel that impatience that Vanilla worries about? What's the newspaper to do?
There is. Developing impatience with the pace of change. People are prepared to listen up to a certain point, but we're going through a whole economic phase here where the economy is actually shedding jobs instead of creating them, and that is in a situation where about 40% of the people who should be working are actually unemployed. So there's growing poverty, which is fueling this impatience. Our role as a paper is to reflect that that impatience, that debate that is taking place within this country, whether Thabo Mbeki's decision to embrace globalization and work with the IMF and the World Bank is paying off beyond the good graphs that show that economic growth is happening at 3%, whilst in reality, down in the streets where people live, it's more and more people, the graph is going down, jobs are being lost every day. That kind of debate is the challenge that faces us today about where should this country be going, and we reflect that in the columns of our paper.
It is a great worry. You know, something if I may just pick up, I don't know if you in South Africa would like to say this, but, Chris, all along you've been talking about the role of a dissenting journalist. And I sit here thinking back about this. And to me, and I think it applies in South Africa today and anywhere else in the world where journalists exist, the main motivating factor for a journalist, I think, is anger. Once you start ceasing to be angry about a situation you see which is wrong or unjust or which should be tackled by government or private enterprise or whatever, I think you lose something very important in yourself and you cease to be the journalist that you should be, trying to report on the totality of society. The other aspect is I always think of the late Alan Paton, whose name was very well known in America.
Of course.
The author of Cry of a Beloved Country. He was once praised for his courage, and he said it's not courage, it's sheer cussedness. And I think you need that factor also in journalism.
Well said, Ben Pogrind. You're listening to The Connection. 1-800-423-8255 is our phone, or 1-800-423-TALK. Ben Pogrind, late of the Rand Daily Mail, is our guest. His memoir of South African journalism is called War of Words. Michael is on the line.
Hi.
Hello, Michael.
Hi, I think that a previous caller began to touch on what I've been thinking about. I grew up in South Africa and spent most of my life there. And when people here in this country ask me if things have changed, I don't think we can underestimate the impact of being counted as a person for the first time. I don't think we can underestimate the impact of suddenly being given the dignity of being able to vote and everything that comes with that. And yet, I can't help thinking that change has been felt mostly, and I don't know if that's the correct word, mostly by white people in South Africa, in the sense that they've been forced to realize that they're living in Africa, that the absurd experience of being a white in apartheid South Africa, growing up as I did, in this crazy Western enclave, a gilded ghetto, if you will, ignorant of the much greater reality around us, was an illusion. And now for the first time, whites are being exposed to the realities of Africa, and sadly, most notably through crime and violence, which, of course, are issues of poverty and not of race. Firstly, I'm interested to know if this perception of mine is correct. And secondly, I wonder if there's any role that a free and objective press can play in this type of transition.
I think it makes some very good points there. I certainly find when I go there that I see among whites, especially young Afrikaners, the people who were the main oppressors, there's a sense of freedom about them and a confidence which is totally different from the past. They feel part of society. But that's still a minority of whites. From what I can see, most whites are still holding back, and this is understood by blacks, and it is a point of friction. Among blacks, I think there's a confidence. Despite the problems, the people walk with their heads held high, and among the younger people, the better educated people, there's some tremendously good people. I was meeting them on my last trip last year when I was there for some while, and I became very excited by these encounters. I thought, well, if there are enough people like this, of this sort of quality and commitment to a decent country, this place is going to work out very well indeed.
Can I add something else?
Please, Michael.
And it's almost embarrassing to acknowledge this as a South African living outside of South Africa, but when I do encounter former South Africans, be it in the United States or in England, there is a tremendous sense of anger and almost a sense of loss. And invariably, people will say to me, it's so sad. It is so sad what has happened. And I know what they're getting at, and I turn around immediately and I say, yes, it is so sad that people have suffered for so long, continue to suffer. And the legacy of apartheid is rich. Economic apartheid continues to this day. And it is so sad, and I'm not sure where the answer lies.
Michael, thank you. I wanted to ask Mithatha Seydoux how a visionary journalist in South Africa today reports crime and violence. What is to be said about it? How much is to be told about it? How high on the journalistic agenda do you put it? Is there a way to talk about it?
I don't think there's any particular formula. Each story has to be treated on its own merits. In the past, a house breaking in Sandton, which would have been a very lily white area, would get maybe 13 paragraphs with the owner of the house being interviewed about the trauma of getting home and finding their radio stolen or something. Today, that kind of story would not get into any paper at all unless if the crime has been violent and there's been a damage to people's lives in a real sense, you know. So that there isn't any particular formula of dealing with it. It is a problem in the same way that when I lived in Cambridge a few years ago, when I was at Harvard, I would open up the news at 5 or the news at 7 and the first 5 bulletins would be crime. You know, I think that is the normality of today's life all over the world, and South Africa is no exception.
Mithatha Seydoux at the Star in Johannesburg, thank you for joining us. Print the news and be damned, as they say. Keep doing it. Ben Pogrand, thank you for a wonderful book. Thank you for joining us in The Connection. Thank you for an example of adversary journalism, holding a mirror to your own society and talking back out of your own reporting. It's a wonderful life. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is The Connection from WBUR Boston. Funding for The Connection comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where The Connection is produced, and from the Allaire Corporation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Suffolk University's Sawyer School of Management, offering a fully online MBA program designed for busy people. Information at suffolkemba.org. By iCore Technologies, a Microsoft Windows 2000.